You're listening to event audio from the Brookings Events Podcast, part of the Brookings Podcast Network. For more in-depth analysis and commentary from Brookings scholars and our guests, go to brookings.edu/podcasts or listen via Apple Podcasts, on Spotify, or your favorite podcast app. Don't forget to follow us on Twitter at Policy Podcasts.
Good afternoon. Thank you for joining us. My name is Richard Reeves. I'm a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution. I'm delighted so many of you have joined us today for this important event on breaking the cycle, overcoming challenges faced by Black boys and men. Some of you may know that today, November 19th, is International Men's Day. This is a day that sometimes becomes the butt of many jokes, and with good reason. Sometimes it's described as opposed to the other 364 days of the year, which aren't they all days for men? So this issue of whether or not it's appropriate to focus on boys and men is one that remains an important one. One area I think is beyond dispute, which is that when we look at the particular experience of certain men, there is an argument as policymakers and as analysts for looking at the experience of those boys and of those men. And that's particularly true of the experience of Black boys and men. In a few minutes, you're going to be hearing from a moderator today, and my close colleague, Camille Bousset. And Camille runs our Race, Prosperity and Inclusion Initiative here at Brookings. And from the outset of that initiative, Camille made it clear that one of her focuses was going to be on Black boys and men, or boys and men of color, because of the specific disadvantages that they may face, particularly in a US context. Today also marks the launch of some new work out of the Center on Children and Families, which I direct, on the issues faced by boys and men, with a particular focus on boys and men of color and boys and men from less advantaged backgrounds. And so thinking about the ways in which race and gender and class and geography all intersect with each other in order to kind of create different patterns of opportunity, different patterns of inequity, is really at the center of the conversation that I hope we're going to have today. So it's in that spirit that the hashtag for today is International Men's Day. So please do kind of fire your questions in as we go through. And the flow is that I'm going to speak very just over a few minutes and highlight some work which we've just published at Brookings, which really puts some facts on the ground, which can animate our discussion going forward. And then we're going to go into a panel discussion with a couple of exceptional colleagues, as well as Camille, to discuss that work. I also want to thank a couple of my colleagues in my own center, Sarah Unzau and Ember Smith, who have helped kind of pull this together, as well as those who are helping to put this event together for you behind the scenes, Anna, Trevor and Harold, who are kind of helping all of these wheels turn, even if you can't see them. So thanks to you too for making this possible. The trouble with sharing facts, which I'm about to do, when we're comparing outcomes in terms of education, labor market participation and so on across different demographic groups, is to understand the context within which we should see those facts. I think there's a couple of dangers when we share these kinds of empirical findings. And the first danger is that there can sometimes be a sort of assumption that we're always going to use a particular group as the benchmark against which everybody else should be judged, right? So everything is against white men. So wages are always to be compared to the wages of white men. Educational outcomes, marriage rates, you name it. And that there's an implicit bias in there towards what could be seen as what's the norm, rather than recognizing the pluralism and diversity of the kinds of life plans that people may have. I think that's an important concern. But at the same time, I would argue, at least, it is also important to know what those facts are, even if we have to be very careful about the way that we sometimes interpret them. The second danger with sharing this kind of empirical data is that it can lead to what some would think of as a kind of deficit-based mindset. It's always like, what's going wrong? What's the problem? Where are the obstacles? Where's the bad news? And it can become kind of very bad news story, rather than focusing on the kind of positive aspects of kind of much more asset-based approach. And again, my own view is that when we turn to things like looking at policies and programs, which we will over the next hour or so, is that we should have absolutely the kind of what can we learn from what works, rather than a kind of constant lament. What we don't want to do is to turn a hard-headed look at real inequities into a kind of lament. Instead, it should be an animating process. It should be instead a call to arms rather than a call to despair. And it's in that spirit that I'm just going to share a few facts with you today. And please, you know, this is a very brief version of it, but please do check it out on the Brookings site today, as well as the work of my colleagues, Camille, Rashawn, that I draw on quite heavily in this work. So I'm going to share my screen with you now. And if someone can just give me a nod that is coming up okay, you can see it, thank you. Just go through a few of these key facts. So the first thing to do is to think about education, where a lot of inequalities in some ways kind of both are expressed by and exacerbated by education difficulties. And I should say that throughout these few slides I'm going to share, the comparison groups here are going to be Black men, Black women, white men, and white women. Needless to say, there are many, many other groups within kind of society, and the full data are available. But just for the purposes of sharpening this kind of conversation, we're kind of focused on those kind of four demographic groups. So we can see specifically how these kind of different interactions between race and gender kind of play out across Black men and women. So what you'll see in these slides is the race gap on many areas, but also how that race gap kind of differs or is more nuanced for different groups. So here it's kind of, you know, straightforward. You'll see this gradient quite a lot as we go through here. So if you focus, for example, in the middle on bachelor's degrees, this is the proportion of young Americans, so in their late 20s, 25 to 29, who have different levels of educational attainment. And so you can see that there are very different gaps, significant gaps here by race. That's really a big part of the story here. But then as you move up the education distribution, you can also see gaps opening up by gender. So at master's degree level, for example, where of course you see many, many, you know, much lower, you actually see kind of Black women roughly getting the same number of master's degrees as white men, and many less than white women, and Black men being significantly less likely to do so. But you can see a very big race gap at a bachelor's degree level, for example. And so you see, again, right at the outset here, we can see the differences that are kind of playing out in terms of education. This is data that draws on Opportunity Insights led by Raj Chetty. And this is data that got a lot of attention when it was published, not least in a New York Times accompanying piece. And what this piece did was it looked at those who are raised in the poorest households, relatively speaking, the bottom 20%, and then where they ended up as adults themselves, but interestingly, focusing on individual income. And so what you're seeing here is the outcomes for those of different demographic groups, conditional on having been raised in these low-income households, but as individuals, as adults. And what you can see is that the chances of Black men, so there were Black boys growing up in poor households, remaining in this bottom quintile as adults themselves, measured by individual income, is 38%, 7% rising to the top. You see then followed by white women, 30% stuck, 26% stuck, and 20% for Black women. And so the story here is that actually this upward mobility story, at least out of poverty, you can see that there are similar levels in terms of going all the way to the top, differ quite significantly, not only by race, but also by gender, as measured by individual income. It's a very important caveat, the individual income point. That's why I'm highlighting it, because this does not translate, it's important to say, into higher levels of household income necessarily for Black women, because there are differences in the chances to merge incomes within households, and also because to the extent that marriage is taking place within racial categories, the relatively weak economic performance of Black men has a significant impact on the household income of Black women. So they're separated in this chart, but of course we can't treat them separately in real life, but it does show this very, very stark difference in the upward mobility chances of Black boys in particular. This is a relatively kind of well-known earnings chart, which is now kind of looking at earnings, and this is for full-time workers, both hourly and non-hourly in dollars since 79. And you know, the big part of the story here, of course, is the one that we know well, which is that white men are kind of out-earning pretty much everybody else in the labor market, and we know that. But there's a couple of things to point out here, which is that you've seen much slower growth for Black men than for white men. You've seen quite significant growth for Black women, but not as fast as for white women. And in fact, white women have overtaken Black men. And so white women are now earning non-trivial amount more than Black men, having overtaken them at some point in the 1990s. And so, again, I think what you're seeing here is this is much slower growth for Black men and Black women. But the result of that has been to really pull up the incomes, the earnings of white women in particular, whilst white men still do well. And then if you remember the last chart, if you then think about how these incomes may or may not be combined, that has pretty big impact on household economic inequality as well. So that's one labor market story. Also, another part of the labor market story is just Black men. Here, we're just comparing with just Black men and white men, because there's been such a big shift in overall labor force participation among women, and the Black women have always had pretty high levels of labor force participation by comparison to other groups. So this just shows you what we already know, which is that there's been a drop in labor force participation among men in general. But if anything, that drop has been somewhat sharper among Black men, and that there remains a very significant gap between them. This is actually more recent data that Ember and Sara have kind of pulled together from us from CPS, which actually does a very kind of snapshot look at what's happened to these four different groups during the COVID pandemic. And you can sort of see the sort of starting point here in terms of the unemployment rate. So here we're looking at the unemployment rate. And you're seeing well-established fact is that, you know, whatever the unemployment rate, it's pretty much always twice as high for Black Americans than it is for white Americans, both men and women. And so you're seeing here that that's kind of before we come into COVID. COVID hits, and then there's just massive, massive increase in unemployment, of course, for everybody. And then it starts to come down again. But interestingly, it comes down much faster for white men and white women than it does for Black men and Black women. So this, the stickiness of the labor market effects of COVID is absolutely not race blind. And you're seeing that very strongly here. This is one point where it is worth pointing out that that trend is even sharper for Hispanic Americans, if they were on the chart as well. Life expectancy is a very good measure of any number of aggregate effects, economic, social, and health effects. And so it's used very often as a kind of proxy for quality of life. It's well known that women live longer than men. That's true in every country in the world. There's a gender gap in life expectancy. But also what we're seeing is a quite significant gap in by race as well. And so it is true that women live longer than men, and that's true for Black women and white women, but white women do somewhat better than Black women. And both do significantly better than men. But interestingly, white men really outperform, if I can use that phrase, Black men in terms of life expectancy on a couple of measures. And here, I think it is important to think hard about the measures of life expectancy. Very often, life expectancy measures are just the ones at birth. And sometimes there are different ages. And so what this chart shows you is, what is the life expectancy at birth? And then what is the life expectancy conditional on reaching age 65? And the reason we've done it that way is actually to kind of tease out two different effects. So you can see that there is this gap in life expectancy. And here I'm focusing particularly on the difference between Black men and white men, where I think that's really where the action is in this chart. And in kind of particular, you're sort of seeing these gaps here at birth. And so you're seeing a really significant gap between the chances of the life expectancies of Black men and white men. But a lot of that is explained by the differential chances of getting to age 65. So long story short, a big part of the reason why the life expectancy of Black men is low is because they're so much more likely to die younger than other groups. And I think that speaks to a very, very specific inequality that is not shared by other groups. So if you look at the difference between white men, Black women, white women, yes, there are differences, but you really don't see this sharp distinction unless you look at the life expectancy for Black men conditional on not making it to 65. Work that I've done with Sarah Reber and Tiffany Ford, who's a research analyst and a Rubenstein fellow in our center, age adjusts the death rate from COVID. I've been banging this drum for a long time now and continue to bang it a little bit more, which is so many of the COVID death rates that you're likely reading in the press do not adjust for age properly. If you adjust for age properly, then you see very, very stark race differences in the death rate risks from COVID-19, and especially for Black men, and then followed by kind of Black women. So that is very, very striking difference that we see there. And then last, perhaps best known, but not least, and in some ways a kind of predictor, aggregator, and expression of lots of these other inequalities, is of course the issue of incarceration and the hugely different risk that Black men in the United States, it's a carceral state anyway, the gray wastes of the American carceral state, to use Ta-Nehisi Coates' phrase, is really those gray wastes are dominated by Black men. Again, we kind of know this, but just one way to sharpen the point is to look, as we do here, at what proportion of those in the prison population are in these different groups. Black men, white men, Black women, and white women. And then what proportion of the overall adult population is accounted for by those groups too. So this is a way of seeing the extent to which certain groups are over or underrepresented in the prison population, given the share of the population that they account for. What's really striking about this is less, I think, the gender story, which is well known, that whilst there are obviously women who are in prison, vast majority of those who are imprisoned are men, but actually the proportion of prisoners who are white men is not that different to the proportion of the population who are white men. And so the overrepresentation story is all over here, this kind of black men. And obviously that's something that kind of both reflects and kind of predicts all kinds of other inequalities. And so I'll stop sharing my slides at that point and just conclude by saying, I think this is the kind of evidence that should lead us to think hard about what the facts are that we need to confront as we think about policies specifically for black boys and black men. I think we have to think not just about racism, but anti-black racism, and not only about anti-black racism, but anti kind of particular groups of the black population, and in particular, black boys and men. The work that Camille led, that I was a co-author on in Social Capital in Charlotte, described an aggressive disinvestment in Charlotte-Mecklenburg in black boys. I think that's an example of the sort of challenge we face. And for me, this speaks to the need for an intersectional approach. Intersectionality, understood properly, is all about the need to think about the different kinds of patterns of inequality. And I think when it comes to the issues of race in particular, and the specific experience of black boys and men, thinking intersectionally is not a luxury, it's absolutely a necessity. And it leads us to actually some more complex conclusions than some of the general narratives around inequality might lead us to. There's lots of reason to hope. But I think before we can be hopeful, especially as we enter this new moment, transition of government, et cetera, a moment of profound racial reckoning, then I think it is a good time also for us to take this kind of specifically gendered lens at the way we look at racial inequity in the US. With that, I'll stop and I'll hand to my colleague, Camille Bousset, who I've mentioned before, is the director of the Race, Prosperity and Inclusion Initiative and a senior fellow in governance studies here at Brookings. So Camille, over to you.
Great. Well, thank you. Richard, that was a fantastic summation, I think, of all the data that we have seen that shows the disproportionate impacts of racism on Black men in America. And I think, as everybody can tell, you know, we have been in a crisis for a long time. And I just want to applaud you, Richard, for years of focus on Black men and on the condition of Black men. And I think we are now, as you mentioned, at a point, particularly with a change in the administration, of having an opportunity to really understand how to address the dynamics that you, that are implicated in the data that you shared with us. So we're going to move into a panel discussion, and we're going to be joined by two colleagues. I'm going to introduce Dr. Sean Joe, who's the Benjamin E. Youngdahl Professor of Social Development, and the director of the Race and Opportunity Lab at Washington University in St. Louis. And then, of course, my colleague, Dr. Rayshawn Ray, who's a David Rubenstein Fellow here in the Governance Studies program at Brookings, and is also a professor of sociology and the director of the Lab for Applied Social Science Research at the University of Maryland, College Park. So welcome, gentlemen. Great to have you both here. I wanted to start off our discussion delving a little bit more deeply. Both of you are sociologists and have really worked on what the various distinctions are between Black men and Black women and this intersectionality that Richard is talking about. And so I wanted to spend a little bit of time explaining to our audience why we want to focus on Black men in particular, and what is unique about their situation in the U.S. apart from the descriptive statistics that we just saw that Richard provided. And Richard, of course, you'll be part of this discussion. So I'm going to start with Rayshawn and then move on to Sean and then Richard on that question.
Well, Camille, thank you. As always, it's great to be with you. Richard, great job with giving an overview of what is really going on. And then Sean, I really look forward to your comments as well. Camille, I think the bottom line is that when Richard mentioned intersectionality and an intersectionality framework, which does have its lineage and its roots in Black feminism, it's important to note the way that it can be applied to different groups, particularly when we highlight Black men. And part of what people have to understand is that we can't simply look at race in a vacuum, nor can we simply look at gender in a vacuum. Instead, what has to happen is that race and gender, because we all have race, gender, and class identities, as well as sexual identities, that they come together to not simply be additive, but they end up being multiplicative. And part of what that means is that you can have people in the same exact setting and they have divergently different experiences in the exact same setting, like neighborhoods, for example. So a lot of work that I've looked at has looked at what are the different experiences of people when they are in predominantly white versus predominantly black and then racially integrated neighborhoods. And one thing that collectively this work highlights is the role that structural conditions play in people's lives. Segregation, and we kind of continue that we currently have a 21st century redlining in effect. I mean, during COVID, if people didn't realize that beforehand, they definitely do now, as it relates to the outcomes that Richard just highlighted with the COVID disparities. It's not simply about Black people being 2 to 3 times more likely to die from COVID, but it is also the impact that it's having on Black men acutely. And part of what that has to do with is the type of jobs that Black men tend to be in, or the fact that Black men aren't even in the labor force to begin with. But one thing we know about employment is that Black men are overrepresented in the bottom 15 occupations, meaning occupations that have the best salary, that have kind of the best opportunities for growth, also come with the best resources, the least exposure to certain types of toxins and other sorts of things. They are overrepresented in the worst 15 occupations for men, and they are underrepresented in the top 15 occupations for men. This partly has to do with income, but it also has to do with the available jobs that are embedded in local neighborhoods. That then spills over into healthcare. We know that people's healthcare is still intrinsically tied to their employment. And if you're less likely to be employed, or if you're more likely to be underemployed, part of what that means is that your healthcare is going to also suffer, not just when it comes to healthcare utilization, but also healthcare access. And the final thing I'll say on this point is when we start talking about policing and criminalization, because that's one of the big things to highlight. That's one of the spaces where we see some of the most disparities between Black men and other groups, including white men. There are a few structural components that people need to bear in mind. The first big one deals with exposure to policing. We know that Black men live in neighborhoods that are over-policed and underserved. So part of what that means is they are overly profiled, but then when they need assistance, that 911 responds slower or sends police when they actually need ambulatory services or mental health specialists. Part of what this has led to is two quick things. First, that Black people are 3.5 times more likely than whites to be killed by police when they're not attacking or have a weapon. Every 1 out of 1,000 Black men can expect to die due to police violence in their lifetime. And some of the work that I've done with some of Sean's colleagues, Dr. Hedy Lee, Dr. Keon Gilbert, and others, part of what this collective research has shown is the impact that policing has, particularly around drugs. We have to be very clear that the 1986 drug bill, people always hark on the 1994 crime bill, but the 1986 drug bill under Reagan created disparate outcomes for Black men versus other groups, even when we control for the likelihood of being stopped, being frisked, and being arrested. Research overwhelmingly shows that Black men are less likely to be doing something criminal at the time that they're stopped. But because so many of them are being stopped repeatedly, it increases the likelihood that they might end up being arrested for something.
Okay, well, that was very sobering. Thank you very much, Rashawn, and certainly a wealth of information for us to delve into as we continue this discussion. Sean, I wanted to get your thoughts on why you think being a Black man in America is a unique situation.
Interestingly enough, so I just want to thank you all. I think this is a very important conversation. Happy to be a part of it, so thank you all. You know, I thought where to begin, and I appreciate where Rashawn has framed this. So I want to go back a little bit. You know, August Wilson, playwright, has once said that Black men are the commodity of flesh and muscle, which has lost its value in the American marketplace. Like we're a leftover of history. The idea there is that Black males or any viable age male who are not engaged in the American economic system and fully getting the experience where they are able to achieve the American dream, if you don't have these males engaged, your whole ecosystem is impacted. So one of the main things to understand here is that our urban centers in particular feel this, that if Black male economic mobility is not part of their strategy, they will always be limited in their growth. They'll always be limited in their social situation, circumstances, health, and they'll be strapped with a lot of the social ills that we see today. So the Black male experience has always been directly tied to the urban center experience and an American experience. So it matters how well this population is doing. So I just wanted to make that point. But the other thing that's very unique, and I think the intersectionality brings this out, is that in this American caste system, right, this system of structure that deems one group higher than the other, that looks at skin color and all these characteristics to then be able to pigeonhole, to control, and to direct that caste system, as Isabel Wilkinson says, that level of a system then dehumanizes Black male labor, does not engage in them or even value it. So what we're struck with right now is that one of the things I look at is premature death. One of my areas of expertise is suicide. And it really gets to the point at this, is that Black males die younger than Black females, right? They both have super exposure to some of the same threats. In fact, Black females have a triple threat of marginalization, right? But still, in almost every age group, Black males account for 60 to 80 to 90% of all suicides. So they're not having the same experience with American society. And it really points to that very different experience. Even Black children who are under the age of 12, who now have higher rates of suicide than white children, breathe that in for a second. They also have higher rates. Males have higher rates of suicide. So again, the experience in America has always been very gendered. It's always treated Black males in a more marginalized or dehumanizing way. And that has consequences for the things that Richard is highlighting in the data that he presents, but also has consequences for the ability for our urban centers and for the nation to truly have a very more robust economic health and a robust social health in our country. So those are some of the differences.
Great. Thank you very much. Richard, do you want to add to that?
Yeah, I'd love to. It was great to hear those perspectives. Thank you. Think about this from a horribly abstract point of view to start with. If you just look at the data, and you have to kind of like, there's this, philosophers talk about a veil of ignorance, right? You have to decide where you're going to be in a society without knowing who you're going to be, right? If you knew, let's say you knew one thing about yourself and you knew that you were going to be male, right? And then the next thing was going to be, what race are you going to be, right? So say you didn't have any choice about your gender, but then in this kind of crazy thought experiment, you could choose your race. If you're white and what you're measuring is those sort of outcomes, you know, in some thought experiment, it's pretty clear which way you would go, much less clear if you were black. It seems to me perfectly plausible, but based on the descriptive data that is there, if you knew your race, but you got to choose your gender, it is not quite clear to me. Just on a purely kind of thought experiment rational way that you would go male. And I think what that speaks to is this point about intersectional, right? We talk about institutional racism and we increasingly talk about institutional sexism. But the way I interpret the data, but also just some of the broader qualitative evidence is that Black men in America face institutional sexism. They also face institutional racism, but they face institutional sexism in the education system, in the labor market, in the criminal justice system. And by that, what I mean is that because they're Black, they're treated differently as men. And so we've got to think about the combination of institutional racism, institutional sexism, and to be able to say that Black men face institutional sexism, right? That they are treated differently than a Black woman would be under those same circumstances. That's a difficult thing to get our heads around, but very important in this debate, I think, that we're able to do that. And that lastly brings us to how we think about the notion of patriarchy. So we have this idea of patriarchy now, which I think has become a little bit too simplistic, and it's just kind of men dominating women. But actually, historically, the definition of patriarchy has been about a certain group of men, typically a small group of men, dominating everybody else, including the men. And so patriarchy is not a men over women, at least it wasn't. It was actually a kind of a group of men who have a particularly privileged position who dominate everybody else. And I think that actually we need to start thinking about the idea of patriarchy in a much more racialized way too, if we're to kind of make progress.
Excellent points. Thank you all for that. No, I want to talk a little bit about facts and statistics and experiences that we've been discussing here. And Really focus now on the longitudinal picture. And what I mean by that is, you know, as Richard showed in many of his charts, for literally decades, there has been a huge gap between the outcomes of Black men and others. And that those gaps have rarely narrowed and often increased over time. And that is happening at the simultaneously with lots and lots of programmatic approaches and monies and programs that seek to really focus on advancing the fortunes of Black boys and Black men. And so now what I want you to do, and you know, of course, most recent of which and probably most renowned of which is My Brother's Keeper, but there are just lots and lots of programs like that. So what I want us now to do is think a little bit and talk a little bit more critically about, you know, given where we know Black men stand in this society, the kind of sexism and racism that they are dealing with, what are the kinds of approaches that we think will actually yield advances? And why is it that this plethora of programs and attention over decades has not really narrowed the gap in outcomes? And in some cases, we see an increase in that gap. So I'm going to start with you, Sean, then move on to Richard, and then Rayshawn.
Thank you. Excellent point, Camille. So let me highlight a few things. And Richard, I want to go back to what you're saying. So I do, and I think many people would understand this, that there is a there is a sexism related to men in terms of we have a cultural norm around males. One, males, you cannot ask for help. Males, and in case if you need help, we have a problem if you need help. Like we have very few policies that say if men need help, and even men with children, what would we do to support them? We say you have to go get a job. We don't care how you get it. We don't care how much it is, but we're not here to support you. And those sort of things are experienced by Black males as well. And in fact, you know, if you look at particularly child custody related issues, these men are disproportionately less likely to get their voices heard, less likely to be able to make an argument for their children, less likely to have their children have time with their children. And particularly, even though Black men are more likely in non-custodial situation want to be involved with their children's lives and spend more time in their children's lives than white males. But that brings up the point that being male in our society has always had that stigma and those different set of straitjacket expectations that limit our ability to help them, but also limit their ability to ask for help when they need help psychologically and even economically. So that has an impact on us. But let me go back to your bigger question. Part of the challenge with a lot of this work is, first of all, how's experience in our urban cores? And that's where most of my work as a social worker, that's where I fit in. We say, how does a person fit into the environment? And for us to understand how to make that environment better and for them to yield better outcomes. So take St. Louis, where most of my work is happening. All of these things happen or experience in a homegrown way. Whether it's Baltimore, New York, where I grew up, or St. Louis or Chicago, they're experienced in a very homegrown way, which means those regions create the level of Black male outcomes that they experience. So thus the solutions have to be thought about in a homegrown way. Two, you have to be longitudinal. A lot of what we've been dealing with over the last 50, 80 years is about progress, not transformational change. So we've had smaller groups of successes that we can highlight, key programs, right? But we've never fully cultivated an interest in Black boys and young men. Let me say boys, because nobody wants to talk about them as children, just men. But anyway, we'll get back to that. I think Rayshawn understands that point too, that we have to focus now on a longitudinal strategy. These 5-year, 4-year, expecting to change what this country has done in over hundreds of years, we want to change in 5 years and with dollars that amount to 5 million, 2 million. This is something that all in a region must get on board on and then invest. This takes time. So in St. Louis, we went from in 1980, where Black males 18 to 29 earned about $30,000 a year, median personal income. You know what they earn now? about $11,000 a year. So over 40 years, things have gotten worse. The reason it's getting worse because, and that doesn't mean innovative things are not happening on the ground. We have excellent different initiative, community-based organizations, strategies, My Brother's Keeper, which is what I run out here. None of those things will make a difference in terms of population level outcomes if you don't try to be intentional about bringing about population change. What does that mean? You change the systems that help them to heal and grow. That includes schools. You have to do a better job on how those systems are functioning and how do you support innovation in those systems. Then you must have the capacity as a region to be able to guide that work strategically and in, to do data-driven specific investment in terms of things that work. It's like a region, it's like having a chamber of commerce around Black male economic development. If you don't put the systems in place, you are getting exactly what the system is designed to do. So right now, our outcomes are what we are designed to do. And there's no way to wish ourselves out of it. We must be as intentional in policy, structure, and the use of information.
Thanks, Sean. Richard?
I think it's a great and very challenging question, Camille. And I would answer it by saying that the reason why many of the programs and investments haven't worked as well as we would have liked thus far is because this is a much deeper issue. This is something that I think really is kind of quite embedded in our culture and on our institutions. And I think that if I could say it, you know, if I had to simplify horribly, it is because Black boys and Black men are isolated in American society. And I'm using that as a verb, not just an adjective. They are actually isolated because Black boys and Black men are seen as threatening by predominantly white institutions, even if those institutions have many women in them, like education institutions. There is something very specific about the way that institutions look at Black boys and Black men. And the danger is that even as we drive towards more racial equality and racial justice, lots of institutions will actually be much more comfortable embracing Black women than they will embracing Black men, because Black men are seen as much more threatening at a very, very deep level. And so I've come, of course, there's lots of things we can do in terms of policy, wealth redistribution and investments in the right kinds of education tracks and so on. But as even the work you led, Camille, in Charlotte recently kind of showed, like the number of men that Black men say they can turn, number of people that Black men say they can turn to is like one. And so this issue of kind of just being specifically isolated from the institutions of support, and that can only rest, I think, on this combination of racism and sexism that Black boys and men uniquely face. I'm saying that deliberately, uniquely face in American society. And until we can make some moves around that, this institutional rejection of Black boys and men, then I think all the money in the world won't actually solve the problem.
Okay, thank you, Richard. Rashawn?
Yeah, I'll just double down on these great points. When we look at what it means to be included in social life, working, participating in civic activities, research documents, and Keon Gilbert mentions this a lot, that 1.5 million Black men are missing from social life. They're not in employment. They don't have anything going on with healthcare. And this is even including the fact, like, there are some things that we don't always focus on that people don't expect. For example, Black men actually have a higher likelihood of joining the military, right? Showing their favorability toward service. Black men are also more likely, and I think Sean and Richard alluded to this, they are also more likely to participate in the household as fathers relative to white men. They are more, when they have kids under five, they are more likely to bathe them. They are more likely to feed them. They are more likely to spend time with them. When they have teenagers, whether custodial or non-custodial, they are more likely to do homework with them, pick them up, take them to things. These are statistics that people don't readily focus on. So we have to ask ourselves, how does a group of people who participates in the role that we expect them to, with all of the social services and judicial challenges that we heard earlier, the fact that when Black men go to court to try to get custody or make arrangements for their children, the barriers put in place are extreme. They're astronomical. Just one example, I did not want to give a pop culture reference, but I think it's relevant here. Chris Rock, who I think most people know, comedian, wealthy, lives in New York. He said that when he was going to get shared custody for his children, he said he purchased a home a mile down the road from the house that he was currently paying for, where his children and ex-wife were living. And he said the judge railed him, like, where is the house? Do you have a bed in the home? How do we know that you're going to be on time to pick them up? And he was like, what? These are the questions? This is where we're starting it. And so the logic oftentimes becomes that men don't get custody of their kids because they don't have the money or the resources. When you are actually in custodial court, you see different things playing out. Now, being fair, we know that women are much more likely to do the second shift, do the caregiving and that sort of thing. That's definitely true. And everyone needs to know that on International Men's Day. That's part of why this day happens. But we have to realize the racial disparities. Part of what we're hearing is that we have to take a life course, comprehensive and corrective approach. Part of the corrective approach means that we have to realize that if we only start with programs from here to the future, we have things that have happened in the past that we haven't corrected for that we've been hearing about. Part of taking a comprehensive approach means you can't only focus on healthcare or the economy or neighborhoods. You have to focus on them all collectively. And part of thinking about the life course is that there are challenges that Black boys face that elderly Black men may or may not face, but then experience new challenges older in life, particularly around coping, particularly as it relates to healthcare utilization. So it's a couple of things I want to mention. First, Sean mentioned some great programs in St. Louis. There is a Black barbershop study there that's phenomenal. There's one in Maryland. There are several around the country that are simply phenomenal to meet people where they are. That's one thing. We also know that there are other sorts of programs, for example, like reentry programs. I think that is a really big space that needs to be filled. One thing that's happened is there is currently bipartisan support for helping people reenter society as returning citizens. There's bipartisan support for it. We have, we're building a working group out to focus on these particular issues. The reason why that's significant is because there are investments at the federal, state, and local level to deal with this. However, we have to ensure that there are employment opportunities and that people can get trained. One thing that Richard mentioned he mentioned about certain occupations, health and education. These two occupations have a lot of vacancies, but Black men are the least likely group to be in those spaces. And a lot of it does have to do with criminalization and threat. The fact that people are literally worried about Black men taking care of them and also of teaching their children. This is something cultural that we really have to get past, because what research documents is that Black teachers and Black healthcare providers, particularly Black men as role models, help to almost single-handedly alter some of the outcomes that we're talking about. And so we really need to focus on reentry programs. We need to focus on employment. And we also need to double down on entrepreneurship programs and investments in local communities.
Great. Thank you all. I mean, all three of you have just, proffered some really interesting observations and some proposals. What I want to turn to now is thinking through the origins or the genesis of the kinds of outcomes that we're seeing. Part of it has to do with this deep-seated distrust of Black men, and part of it has to do with a very deliberate sort of isolation of Black boys and Black men in society. So given all that, I want to ask you two related questions. The first is, what are the best types of public policies that we could be pursuing that might change these outcomes over time? And number two, I want to celebrate Black men in my life as my colleagues and my family members, et cetera. How can we involve Black men themselves in creating and championing these public policies? So I am going to start with Rayshawn, then I'm going to move to Sean, and then Richard.
Camille, you have the best questions. These are loaded questions. I was hoping to go last again. Sorry.
No rest.
When I think about the public policies, I tried to highlight a couple. I think the biggest thing is about not just representation, but inclusion. People have been hearing a lot about diversity, equity, and inclusion. It's not simply about being included. It's also I mean, it's not simply about equity. It's also about inclusion. Who is sitting at the table to make the decisions? John Lewis always talked about this, him and Shirley Chisholm, about how it's not about just being at the table after you get there, but it's having the ability to actually purchase the groceries and then help prepare the meal that goes on the table. If we use that symbolism to think about policy, that's where the gaps have been. That for too long, people have been making decisions about Black people and Black men without having our input at the table. And that is something that I think in this next administration, in the Biden-Harris administration, based on the transition picks and other decisions that have been made, that that's going to be front and center, and that's going to be comprehensive throughout their administration. I'm going to double down again on focusing on criminal justice reform, because I think when we look at, now there are huge disparities in mortality, there are huge disparities in education, but when we look at incarceration, that's one of the places where we see the starkest disparity, particularly even between Black men and white men, and we can trace its origins. Like, people know that it has to do with the drug bill in 1986. People know that it has to do with the crime bill in 1994 and mass incarceration. So given that we have bipartisan support there, I think it's a lot of momentum to double down on vocational and technical training for the occupations where there are gaps. We talked about education. We talked about healthcare. We could even look at tech jobs. This is the wave of the future. And Black men are far behind in being trained for these types of occupations. And so part of that means that when people are in prison, when people are incarcerated, also when Black males get put in diversion programs, their diversion programs should include vocational tech and healthcare training to prepare them for occupations. And then, more importantly, it's not just preparing them for occupations. We need to set up a pipeline that gets them into those occupations, that literally provides funding to create occupations specifically for them as a corrective of the past. And then finally, when it comes to celebrating them, I mean, look, I think that there are so many things that Black people, and in this case, Black men, overcome every single day that people don't readily know. Personally, one thing that I'll say is when a lot of the stuff that's happened in 2020 and over the years since I, you know, study these issues, and I have conversations with colleagues and oftentimes white male colleagues, and I make a statement to them about the role that racism plays and what it means to have overcome that. I say, you know, oftentimes I will have conversations with the people who collect my trash, the men, mostly Black men who collect my trash, take water to them, other things out the house. Why do I do that? Well, I hope I think I'm just a nice person, but it's also deeper than that. It's also the fact that I realize that my life is linked more to theirs than it is to my colleagues in the offices next door to me. And I think that when people have overcame things, it becomes so normative that we make assumptions to not celebrate that. And there are so many people, like a person who I've studied and worked with, Chris Robinson, who is a returning citizen, who is now a single father taking care of his daughter, and who has worked at the same place for 20 years. He's just wanting to live his life. But you know the unfortunate reality? He's stopped by police every month of his life. In the past 10 years, he's been stopped over 100 times. So part of the celebration, actually, is the fact that Black men have been able to overcome continuous forms of systemic racism and still be able to put a smile on their face when they look at their kids, when they walk into work to see their colleagues, and they still try to go to the polls. They still try to take care of themselves. And we don't celebrate those small things enough, because the structural elements that try to prevent them from doing that literally create barriers to their happiness. And it's something we need to celebrate, and we don't talk about it enough.
Thank you, Rayshawn. Sean?
I'm just going to pick up. So our approach is, a homegrown strategy is what really needs to happen, where you're doing this over 10 to 20 years, that you have to create the will to value Black males and invest in Black males, boys to young men. And you have to prioritize those age groups that I think we often don't spend a lot of time valuing. That's those between the ages of 12 to 29. And those are the age groups that's often represented in some of the data that Richard has presented. So once you move towards cultivating that level of will, and put it in the context of some data I think I just pulled from Richard and your team, that as the American middle class is now more diverse, right? that it used to be 84 or 80 something percent white. Now it's 50 something percent white. It raises a question. Did the pie increase and are we sharing more? Because at the root of all of that is the fear that feeds the dehumanizing system that we've been talking about and structures that doesn't allow all of us to benefit from what America has to offer and marginalizes Black males' economic mobility. I think it is a focus on economic mobility, but in order to do that, it gives you a very clear outcome and you have to help them heal from the trauma, from their experiences, grow, matches to the skill sets they need to have, pay them a livable wage. That means I think jobs is the central linchpin to this, a job that provides for themselves and their families. If you don't do those things, then you're back here decades after decades with the same conversation. So I think one, you cultivate the interest, the will, showing people that you're not disconnected. COVID reminded us that you're not disconnected. If you live in that very wealthy part of Ladue, Missouri that we know, but you're only, you know, less than 2 miles away from other areas that you, you know, of Black areas, you're tied together. So we make the argument that the economic and social health of every region is dependent on what happens with Black males. Your ability to track companies to your region is dependent on what's happening with Black males. So if we invest upfront over time and personalize the support as Black male go from adolescence to young adulthood, that investment you will reap way beyond what you think you're investing. And you have to move forward with those sort of strategies. Population level. We know it's only 60,000 in St. Louis. You got to know what your population level, the size of your population and what's necessary to move them. This is no longer a piecemeal strategy that will produce transformational change. Otherwise, you'll get progress, which is not bad, but I'm looking for transformation.
Great. Thank you very much, Sean. Richard?
So I think the first thing I would say is something very boring, which is knowing more. And just in terms of data, I think the influence of some of the work from Raj Chetty on mobility has been hugely influential. I've spent a lot of, one of the reasons I'm interested in this work is because I'm very interested in the issue of intergenerational mobility. Not so great in the US. Oh, turns out it's not too bad for whites and actually allowing for a certain amount of time, not too bad for recent immigrants. Why is it so bad? It's because it's very bad for Black Americans. So turns out it's particularly bad for Black boys. And so it's one of these things that you, that at every degree of magnification, you come to realize that the issue of mobility, this intergenerational question, is highly racialized, but it's also about gender. And there's, I think, no exaggeration to say that if we're serious about improving overall mobility in the US, we can't do that unless we improve outcomes for Black boys, period, which is can't. It's actually mathematically impossible, I believe, to seriously change that. So what does that mean? There's a whole list of things that I just want to underline everything we've heard, but I love this idea of being much more intentional about, you know, Black men and Black boys into particular professions, especially the caring professions. We call them, Bell Sorhan and I call them the heel jobs as opposed to the STEM ones, and, you know, health, education, administration, and so on. And I think there's a strong case for scholarships and incentives to get many more Black men and Black male teachers. Rashawn's already said this, I think, just huge. The only other thing probably is worth saying, and I think this builds on Sean's point, that it turns out that boys are much more sensitive to their environments growing up than girls are on average, right? Their family environment, but also the place, right? The structure of neighborhoods, the opportunities in neighborhoods, right? There's this old saying in psychology between all kids and dandelions, right? All kids need lots of care to grow, and dandelions grow everywhere. And it turns out that boys are a bit more orchid-like, but they actually more sensitive to economic instability, social instability, concentrated poverty. Those all have a disproportionate effect on boys. And because so many of those boys are Black in those areas of concentrated poverty, what that means is that an effective place-based policy turns out to be, I believe, very important for improving the outcomes for Black boys. And so I'd focus on that, and then obviously education, especially community colleges, but that do a lot of the heavy lifting for us, but where the quotes dropout rates after a year of community college are very striking, particularly for Black boys. And meanwhile, the for-profit sector kind of scoops up many folks and serves them very badly. And so that post-secondary transition, I think you really, as some of the charts I think showed, that's really where you see a lot of these gaps kind of opening up, is between those ages of like 15 and 21. It's like that's where a lot of people can get derailed, and especially Black boys. If we can't get that bit right, then it seems to be going to struggle on every other stage of the life cycle.
Okay, great. Thank you very much, Richard. So we have about 6 minutes left in the program, and I'm going to do a couple of things. First is we've had a number of questions that have come through, and many of them have been already answered as part of the conversation, but there are a couple that haven't been, and so I'm going to just pose those here. So the first is a question around mentoring, and I'm going to paraphrase this, but essentially, the question is about what are some of the best practices for mentoring, for all, in general, but particularly for Black boys, and what are some of the outcomes that we see when we see good practices, best practices applied there? That's number one. And then number two is a question around reparations and the role of reparations policies or programs or approaches in addressing some of the outcomes that Richard set out at the beginning and that all of us have elucidated throughout this conversation. So I'm going to throw it open. Anybody can answer. Just unmute yourself. And then after that, I have one final question for each of you in a lightning round, and then we'll be done. So whoever wants to go, Rayshawn.
I'll just quickly say on the 2 points, on the mentoring part, I'm pretty sure Sean has a lot to say about this too, but some of the work I've done on mentoring suggests that you need 4 qualities. The mentors have to be positive. Academic is the second. That doesn't always mean they have to have gotten a PhD or whatever, but that they consider academics to be important. So positive academic, accessible, and visible. So oftentimes the accessibility part is one of the things that's lacking, is that Black boys see someone who's successful, but they can't readily touch them and hold on to them. Part of that goes back to the structural conditions we talked about in segregation. It's one of the things that I call the Black brain drain. For Black people to be successful, I really don't think people realize how bad and deleterious certain neighborhoods are, like some of the ones that Sean was talking about at the Del Mar Divide in St. Louis, or in North Memphis, where I happen to go to college, or the west side of Baltimore, that in order to do certain things, you have to leave those spaces. So that's the first thing, the 4 components. When it comes to reparations, Andre Perry and I have done a lot of work on this. Sandy Darity and others have done a lot of work on this. What I've come to the conclusion about is that the only way to deal with systemic racism in America is for reparations to happen, is to provide restitution for the centuries of the way that systemic racism is operated in our country. And I think that potentially, definitely in the House of Representatives in 2021 or 2022, I would expect for something to be passed, if not sooner. And then, of course, that will mean in the Senate. But H.R. 40, as well as Barbara Lee's Truth and Reconciliation Bill, are definitely gaining momentum there.
Great. Thanks, Rayshawn. Richard or Sean? Okay, Sean, go ahead.
So in terms of mentoring, good work out there. Mentors and national organizations, the fraternities do a lot of things. Big Brothers, Big Sisters of Eastern Missouri, Boys and Girls Club, great things. However, there has to be a shift. Some still enter mentoring as saviors. And I said, you're not going to be saviors. I'm a Christian. I believe there's only one savior. But you have to move towards sponsorship. And that's the thing with Black boys. Put your reputation and social network on the line to sponsor them into opportunities. And I think if you don't take that tack, then you wouldn't have the right mentoring ecosystem. And then third, you must provide, I think, innovative policy, block grant type strategies for community innovations around some of these key pivotal resources, whether it's mentoring, whether it's schools, whether it's how to do better personal safety strategies that better impact Black males, right? You have to shift that lens. So I just want to make that point.
Great. Thanks, Sean. And Richard, did you want to?
I'll pass and let, because I want to hear your other question as well. And then maybe.
Okay. So my question is, the Biden administration has called you. What is the one policy they need to pursue to improve things for Black boys and Black men in the U.S. during their term? Richard.
I'm only allowed one, right? So I have to do criminal justice reform. But if I was allowed to, I would definitely go for place-based policy next. And just while I'm speaking, because I think we may run out of time, reparations, particularly I think at a local level, I think is where the action is going to be. And the only thing I'd add to the four on mentoring, which I think is implicit in what Ray Sean is saying, is durable, lasting. I think the evidence is that mentors who come and go actually can be actually harmful. And so there's kind of this, there has to be a lasting and long-term kind of relationship, but that would be my answer.
Okay, great. Thanks. Sean?
Place-based strategy that focuses on changing the opportunity zone structure, meaning that these opportunity zone grants, they're benefiting developers, but don't really facilitate opportunity structures in the region. They have to facilitate a better opportunity structures, and we can study that, measure that, and help to guide that.
Great. Excellent. Thank you, Rayshawn.
Ditto. I'm not going to take up any time. The criminal justice part, Sean nailed how we need to think about opportunity zones. They don't need to gentrify neighborhoods. They need to restore neighborhoods and invest in neighborhoods. And that's really what we need to see.
Can I give one example? I want to check if I'm right about this, of a small policy change. If I'm correct, it is the case that if you are convicted of a drug-related crime, you're ineligible for Pell Grant support.
That's correct.
Right.
Yep.
Like, what are we thinking at that point? What was, I know the history of that, but it's like, if you could design one policy that was actually intended to punish a particular group of people who most need post-secondary education, what you do is you say, well, okay, you've got a drug crime, so no Pell Grant for you. So if I'm going to add one tiny addition, it's like, why don't we reverse that stupid policy? I can do that on day one.
Great. Excellent. Well, we are going to have to leave it there. This has been a fantastic discussion. As all good discussions, there's so much more to say. I want to thank Richard very much for all his work in profiling some of these outcomes. Sean for joining us, and of course, Rayshawn for your excellent contributions as well. Thank you all for listening. And with that, we'll say goodbye and join us again for another Brookings event later in the week. Take care.
Thank you, Camille.